This week on the show, we've got Connecticut's new emperor of check-ins. Talk about the rules of the social road and who's watching Hulu anymore. All this on episode 198. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media. I'm your host this week, Daisy Whitney, and it is a pleasure to be back. So thank you all for listening. You probably know me through the show, but also through the New Media Minute. And can I just remind you, since my book comes out in 2 months, that you can pre-order The Mockingbirds on Amazon. Comes out November 2nd. All right, that's my pitch, but I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that project that I'm working on. Oh, I have lovely guests and co-hosts today, too. Hello, Alex. How are you? It's Alex Lindsay here with me, as always.
Hello from Petaluma, California.
All right, I shouldn't say as always. It's more like randomly.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, randomly. And you know, I'm home for a month, and then after that, it'll be from all over the world.
Where will your journeys take you next?
We have a series of shoots 2 weeks from now. One in London, Paris, and Amsterdam. So, oh, like, day in each one.
could I come along to the Paris shoot?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
of people wanting to come along to those.
Yeah, exactly. Those are pretty good. And then it looks like I might be going down to Rwanda if some of our proposal stuff goes through. And then I'll be in New Mexico, Washington, D.C. speaking, New Mexico speaking in October, and then in November I'm in Vegas speaking, and then back to Africa, and it just kind of looks like that for the next 6 months. So I'll definitely be checking in from all over.
Wow. Okay. I'm exhausted thinking about it. Tim Street, how are you? Are you keeping cool in Los Angeles today?
I've got the AC cranked, and I'm just mentally preparing for filling in for Alex when he's gone at all these events.
That's why we've got a lineup of people here, because we're always, all of us, especially in the last few months, have been out and about on the road more, doing more things. So it's great to have such a reliable stable of talented folks to call on. And also Lon Seidman from Connecticut, which, it's probably just been hot there all summer. We're sitting here complaining about the heat in California because it's been 50 degrees most of the summer.
Yeah, it's been hot here, and you know what's funny? It's actually in the upper 60s with a nice breeze blowing. It's like fall, and we're loving it. Actually, for foliage watchers, we're seeing some foliage change already because of all the heat, believe it or not. So I'm starting to see some color on the trees outside.
So that's all that global warming stuff. If somebody is tuning in for just the first time ever for This Week in Media, Lon Seidman is with local online news TV. That's his venture that he started. Tim, I didn't fully introduce properly. He is with M Dialogue now and is doing all sorts of interesting stuff with mobile video. And of course, if you guys are tuning in, you know Alex. Anyway, all right, we are going to dive right in. Lots of interesting news to come.
I have a question for Lon.
Sure.
See, look at this. Daisy has a perfectly set up plan.
And then I was like,
I have a hand grenade that I would like to throw into the middle. Hey, Lon, what do you think of the new AOL hyperlocal stuff that they're doing?
You know, it's funny. I actually just met with somebody that was doing hyperlocal video, and I guess they have a whole network of freelancers that they can. She said that they could actually. I just ran into them randomly on the street one day. Actually, she said they can get these people assigned to cover something at a moment's notice. I guess there's a whole crew of people, and I was walking down the street. There was some political event going on. There was three guys with the Canon 5D Mark IIs. All this audio equipment. I said, "Wow, this is pretty impressive." So they're really doing a quantum shift from being an internet provider to being a content provider. We're actually doing some work for Patch.com, which is their hyperlocal news effort, and we have some of our freelancers freelancing for them, which has been good for us and good for them. So I mean, for what we're doing, because we're selling a very portable product, we do video. Hyperlocal news packagey video a lot better than a lot of folks do, and I think it's good for us. But they're moving in very quickly. I was looking on their job board. I think there's about 15 or 20 communities right around where I live that they're getting into with Patch in the near future too. So I think it's good for me. I think some of the incumbent folks, incumbent media, should be concerned. But on the other side of it, there's a lot of independent folks who have small news sites that have been around here for 5 or 6 years, because we've seen a very slow retraction of local media, and I think they're gonna be fine. I think there's gonna be just a lot more news than we've ever had around here before, which is actually a good thing.
And Patch just announced that it's now, I believe, in 100 communities around the country. I did an article about a month ago, and at that time it was in 85. So
you know, I think
Daisy,
they're looking for somebody in Mill Valley.
Cover the beat. I know. I noticed that. That was one of the communities that I checked out when I was researching it. So
this could be you. You could be hyper local.
Yeah, I could. I could just be embedded in Mill Valley reporting on the coffee consumption, because that's kind of what we. This, if you've ever spent time in Mill Valley, California, you will notice that most people walk around with a coffee cup in their hands.
Wow.
I don't know. That's all. That's my observation.
It's actually an observation. I'm going to take us down a rat hole just for a second. But the we had one of our partners in Rwanda was visiting, Jerome Gasana, and he was just amazed by how many people were walking down the street with food in their hands. Like he said, you know, in Rwanda, no one ever walks and eats at the same time. You know, it's like, you know, you sit down and you eat. And it was so funny. I even tried, I have to admit, I was just curious. I got him a sandwich at Starbucks and tried to get him to walk with me, you know, and he just couldn't do it. He just had to, sit down and eat the sandwich before it was like asking him, I don't know. It was just so against his grain that he couldn't handle it. So walking with food, just for us Americans, walking with food and drink is very odd to some people.
Well, when I was in Paris earlier this summer, you rarely saw anyone carrying a paper coffee cup or coffee at all. Like in Paris, you go into the coffee shop, you sit down or you stand at the counter and you wait and you drink it there. It's not I gotta get my venti and nurse it all day long. So yeah, but those little cultural
quirks
are interesting. Wow, really, it is. It is. So we're also going to chat a little bit about Apple today and some ITV news and rumors. And Alex, kick this off for us, because I know you're close to following this and kind of what's going on. So let's let our listeners know what's happening.
Sure, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about this on MacBreak Weekly, but I thought that it was important for us to talk about it here, just to mention it, so our listeners don't feel like they were left in the cold by what we were talking about, because it's just a rumor right now. This is, of course, the big fire that blew up was Kevin Rose. We did a blog post, of course, Dig founder Kevin Rose, that there's going to be a new there's going to be an ITV platform running iOS and priced at $99. And he said this is going to change everything. People are going to be able to, you know, buy and download, and there's going to be, this is something that Apple, of course, has been rumored to be working on for a very, very long time. And so the idea is that you'll be able to select a la carte stations, according to Kevin Rose. Networks like NBC and ABC could directly monetize and distribute their content. And one of the things that he's tying into this, which I think is really interesting, is the possibility of the iAds that Apple has been releasing on the iPhone and iPad running on this platform. So you could theoretically still get a NBC or Food Network or whatever and have this iAd platform, so you could still be getting our TV for free. It wouldn't necessarily have to pay a la carte to watch our favorite Burn Notice or Alton Brown or whatever we want to watch. We would still have advertising running underneath it, and it might be just as lucrative or more lucrative for the content providers, and a little bit more civil for the viewers as well. So the rumor is that it'll be September 8th when I'm in.
Wow.
I'll be in Paris. So I won't see much of this. But the rumor is it's coming. It could be coming very quickly, and it could change the landscape pretty dramatically.
So Alex, if you were betting on this, what do you think is the likelihood that this will be rolled out or introduced, rather, in September?
I'd say 60 to 70%.
Okay.
I think that Apple has been moving this direction for a long time. I think September makes sense. I think that, you know, we're seeing Apple very quickly. You know, I think that we could see the iOS really take over Apple's platform by WWDC next year. You know, I think that, there's rumors, there's patents that came out last week that show Apple with an iMac with a touchscreen and the iOS built into it. So it is clear that that's the direction they're moving. They obviously have wanted to get into the living room at this level for a long time. Apple TV, of course, was their quote-unquote hobby.
Right.
And they have probably figured out a lot about what they want that to look like. And so I think that it's pretty probable.
Tim, what do you think about this? Game changer?
Expect your cable and internet connections to skyrocket.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think that if you cut the cable companies out of the equation, which it seems like the whatever this is called, if it's called ITV or Apple TV, I think if it goes wide, because it makes a great gift, buy one for a friend, you're going to see the cable companies cut out, which means they're going to need to charge more mm-hmm. for their services. And a way for them to do that is if you're using them to connect to the internet, they can jack up the bandwidth cost and make it based on usage. So, you know, I think we'll see some type of pricing war go on with internet connections. And hopefully it'll be good for the consumer. But I have a feeling we're going to be charged for our carry-on luggage.
That's interesting. There was an article, I believe it was over the weekend in the New York Times, probably a lot of folks have checked out, called Sofa Wars. It was about, obviously, the explosion in online video, but really looking at, you know, is there cord cutting going on? And, of course, there have been a number of reports suggesting that it's not happening at all, and we're definitely still holding on to our cable and satellite service, maybe even more so, which is interesting, because when you look at all of the other businesses that have been disrupted by the internet, all of those others have suffered as a result of consumption going to the web, especially the news business and the publishing business. But TV so far, you know, is relatively immune. I wonder, though, if Lon, if you feel this starts to change, if this starts to change that scenario, and if Apple's, you know, ITV, over-the-top play, whatever we want to call it, has the potential to have the reach of the iPhone over time.
I think so. If you look at the rumored price of $100, it's almost a no-brainer to toss one of these things on there and get, if they somehow integrate the iPhone apps with this thing. There's been talk of some kind of magic trackpad-like remote control for it that might have some motion sensing on there, that if you can immediately take your software that you're using on your phone or your iPad and move it over to the TV, that's going to be pretty cool. And I think also now that we're seeing more and more local coming to internet video, so, for example, the stuff that we're doing at Local Online News or things that our local affiliates are doing, that suddenly cuts out the issue that for a lot of folks like me that live in more rural areas where we don't get a lot of over-the-air programming, it immediately begins to make that cut. I've been trying to cut my cable out for a while, but my wife has a few channels that she likes to watch that aren't available, Food Network being one of them. Mm-hmm. So I'm paying a fortune that I don't want to pay. So if I could throw the app on there for $20 a month or a year or whatever, and more efficiently get the programs that I want and get local content too, that could be significant. And one of the things that we've seen Apple do over the course of the iPod, the iPad now, we're seeing the same things that they've been able to do in areas of wireless networking, that a lot of the innovations that they bring to the marketplace tend to change the industry. So Apple TV, I think, was probably 2 or 3 years ahead of its time. And if you look at the size of the hardware now that we all walk around with, which is probably more powerful than the Apple TV was when it was introduced, they could probably make some huge quantum shifts in the landscape here with something like that. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's great for us and any video producer to get people watching stuff on their television, which is where I want everybody to see our stuff.
Obviously, another important company that is at the center of many media stories these days is Facebook. Facebook has unveiled its new sharing feature, Places. Alice, I know you've been spending more time on Facebook. I wonder if you are a Places user, but also what you think about this. I mean, this is basically, it's kind of like Foursquare, but on Facebook. It's Facebook's, you know, location-based check-in type of service. And there's some questions surrounding it, obviously, with, you know, privacy, which is always the ongoing issue with Facebook, because, you know, you need to, if you don't want a friend to tag you or check you in, you have to reset your privacy settings, which is par for the course with any change that Facebook makes. So, Alex, what do you think about Places?
You know, I'm torn. The thing that I really want from these, I don't do Foursquare. I don't do Places. I usually don't want people to know where I am at every moment.
I feel the same way.
You know, and I got real sensitive to that. You know, I think that, you know, a friend of mine who is very popular, on the web, you know, she had an issue where someone was following her around. you know, while she's twittering. Like, she'd be like, hey, I'm at the Apple store, hey, and he would show up. And it was a little scary, and it really kind of turned my my attention span up to, yeah, it might not be a great idea for me to let everybody know where I am, you know, where I live, and yep. and where, you know, where I'm doing these things and everything else. And I just, I haven't really gotten that. I do love the idea, and I haven't seen an application that does this yet, which is, when I'm out with a bunch of friends, it would be really great to do something that was really organic and easy for me to find them all at a, like, a fairground. Like, mm-hmm. let's find each other. You know, that would be really useful for me, you know, or my wife half the time, you know, is you know, she's somewhere and I'm somewhere and we can't figure out where we are. And that kind of location stuff is interesting to me. Having lots of people know where I'm at is not that interesting to me. I don't mind people coming up and talking to me about the shows and stuff like that, and I kind of enjoy it, but I think I would stop enjoying it if it happened all the time.
Well, and I've avoided the location-based services, you know, for the some many of the reasons that you've cited already. And Tim, I know that, you know, you and I have had many conversations in the past, and you are also just sort of a passionate advocate of being cautious. You know people who have experienced that kind of, you know, internet stalking that these things can make possible, which is why I think, you know, people just have to make really, really smart decisions about, I mean, if you're using any, and I know this is, we're getting a little bit off topic here and kind of having more of a philosophical discussion, but I just definitely feel very strongly that, you know, if you're going to be using any sort of check-in service, just, you know, be thoughtful before you start using it and make sure that it works for you and your business and your life and your family, because there can be sort of unexpected and perhaps unwelcome repercussions of it. Knowing that, Tim, do you see this taking off? Do you think a lot of people will use it, and how does it start to change the game of location-based services?
Sure. I'm a big user of Foursquare. I really like Foursquare, but I only check in at events usually, or if I'm doing something that's stupid fun. So it's, you know, I'm always in a, you know, public place. It's I try to keep, you know, my private check-ins. Those are phone calls. Hey, I'm over here now. Okay, bye.
There's this great thing called text messaging that works. private check-ins.
Yeah, that's a good one. And I've just started using the Facebook Places, and I like it, but I haven't seen the value that it compared to Foursquare. I haven't seen the value yet, because with Foursquare, I just see my other Foursquare friends, as opposed to Facebook. For me, Facebook people are more personal acquaintances that aren't really of the social media space. I mean, there's definitely crossover there, but for some reason, the Facebook crowd seems to be more, you know, relatives, people I know from high school, that kind of stuff, long lost friends who are trying to keep up on what I'm doing. And with Twitter and Foursquare, that seems, for me, seems to be more of my people who I've met on the internet are in that crowd.
But you're right. No, it's true. And I often feel the same way. I try to sort of apply the same, you know, rules and things that I share and won't share across both venues. But it's interesting the different types of responses that you get for something you post on Twitter or Foursquare versus Facebook, obviously, because of the type of friends that you have. Juan, what do you see as the advantages and disadvantages? And do you think local businesses, small businesses, large businesses will find ways to take advantage of this, just as a lot of folks are finding a ton of ways to take advantage of Foursquare and other location-based services? Let's not forget that there are, you know, there are companies out there like Looped and Whirl and, you know, Philo. Now you can check in with TV shows that you're watching. I mean, they're just, you know, Scavenger. I mean, they're just a host of these services that continue to get funded and people continue to use.
You can check in everything these days and spend all your time doing it, I guess. But I've been surprised on Facebook just at the adoption rate of people in my network. Because like Tim, I think more of my techie friends are, you know, we're doing the Foursquare thing. For example, when I was in LA area about a month or two ago on it for my other job, I kept seeing Tim's name pop up on my iPhone notification thing. So I wasn't stalking you, Tim, but I could have. you know, on the Facebook side, I'm seeing, like, you know, some retirees that I know using this thing, and they just found it and started playing with it. And now they're hitting it every time they go somewhere, which is kind of cool. I don't know how long that'll last for. I mean, this is all kind of shiny and new. One thing I did, though, is I have in my Facebook, I've got about 1,500 people on there, and I don't know all of them personally. I like to have a good size Facebook network. I think there's some value to that. And I've been actually segmenting my Facebook friends into these lists, and I've been doing it for some time now, some of a little curation. And what I did is I designated a subgroup of people that I am comfortable with knowing my location. And I've been a little bit more active on the Facebook thing as to where I'm at, because I know the people seeing it are people that I know aren't going to come and rob me when
I step out. And so you can just update your location or where you are just to those certain subgroups that you are allowing to know. Okay.
Exactly. If you go into the privacy settings, you can specify a list of, you know, your Facebook friend list, and I have one called Location OK. So anytime I have a good friend, I don't care if they know where I'm at, I put them in there, which has helped. And I think from the standpoint of just trying to see if someone is where I am in the area. You know, Connecticut's a small state. You can drive everywhere. I got friends all over the place. It's kind of neat to know if I've got an hour to kill somewhere that, hey, so-and-so might be at this coffee shop. I'll go pop in and say hi, or they might come and find me, and that's pretty cool. You know, and on the Foursquare side, the gaming aspect of it for me was more attractive, especially when I got on early here before most people in the area did. I was like the emperor of the you know, because I was the mayor of everything. And my friends were starting to wonder why I spend so much time at fast food restaurants, and I needed to kind of temper my check-ins a little bit. But you know, there's something about Foursquare that has a little bit more fun to it. That thing when you get the little crown when you become the mayor and your Twitter goes off and says that you're the mayor of this place. It's just it's a neat thing that I think is a little bit more sticky than what Facebook has right now.
Now, on a related note, Michael Learmonth, who is a reporter and editor at Advertising Age, did a really terrific piece late last week called "Are You Building a Useful Social Network or Social Stalking?" Which kind of talks about, you know, the different type of connections that you would make on Facebook versus Twitter versus Foursquare. I'm just wondering, sort of, you know, very quickly, if we can kind of go around, if anyone has any sort of thoughts or best practices. And I know it varies on an individual basis, but just in terms of, you know, that push-pull between social stalking and building a good social network. Alex, do you have any sort of rules of the road?
You know, I as anybody who follows me on Twitter knows, I don't have a lot of rules of the road. You know, I have, you know, I understand that it's something that is useful from a business perspective to have, you know, a Twitter following or whatever. And before that, I had a mailing list. You know, we still have, you know, 40,000 plus people on a mailing list. But the I think that I look at, and I definitely look at what I'm posting as, you know, I try to avoid Twittering drunk.
Yes.
You know, that's, you know, after, and when I say drunk, after usually one or two beers, it's pretty much off limits. You know, I get tempted because it's amazing how much trouble you get yourself into when you have.
Which can I just interject to say, good rule of thumb for everybody.
It's kind of like drunk dialing. It's, you know, it's except that you're dialing a lot of people at one time.
Exactly. Well, don't tweet if you're drinking.
Well, I guess I won't be using Twitter anymore.
So I mean, yeah, anyway, so, you know, I have decided, I guess the big thing that I've done with mine, which is probably not, maybe not the best business decision, but it's the decision I made with Twitter, was that I am, you know, I look at my, that I have a bunch of friends that are, and I don't worry about whether they leave or not. I don't worry about whether it's, you know, I obviously want to entertain them and want, you know, it's something like, ooh, I want to tell them something, or I want to share something that's interesting to me. But I don't worry. I get the quitter. I don't know. Are you guys?
I tried that for a few days and it was just so depressing. I thought, you know what? I don't really need to know who's leaving or at what point. Cause you know, it's always going to happen. People are always coming in and out, so you do track that.
I get it. You know, cause I find it to me, I find it very interesting. So I think that's the reason that I use it.
How often do you get drop offs?
Oh, you get them every day. I mean, you know, I lose probably, you know, I think I gain just a handful of people more than I lose every day. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like a slow,
that's hilarious.
Like it's slow forward progression, you know, what's funny is it tells you like why that, you know, what tweet that, you know, when they left and you're like, really? That's the one that pushed you over? I'm just so surprised. Like you're just like, I don't get it. I don't understand why this person has decided that. And I, as I said, I find it's very fascinating to me because I'm not that attached to my Twitter number. So I, you know, to me, I don't really care whether people are following or not to some degree. You know, I love the fact that there's so many people following. And I'd be bummed if there were 100 people following or something like that, and not, you know, the number that I have. But I, like, I'm not looking to get huge numbers. I just like to have this great kind of family of people. And you don't realize how many people are actually watching your Twitters until you ask a question.
Yes.
You know, like, so if you go up there and you go, you know, you're just doing your little observations. You're not sure if anyone sees this, mm-hmm. you know, and then you put something up and you realize that, you know, a lot of people can lead to a lot of response, like 2 or 3 pages of responses if you ask the right question, you know, across that. And that's, to me, there's a power there of kind of a Google on steroids, you know, that, you know, it's curated in some ways, the way that Lon was talking about, in the fact that, you know, now I'm getting all these people that have been attracted to me because of who I am. Like, my Twitter really is who I am. It's not like a press release Twitter. It's not we have one of those for the Pixel Core and for DB Garage, but this is really just a...
It's you. It's Alex. It's Alex, kind of, you know, a little bit unfiltered. But that's how you are all the time. I mean, you are. But how you are on the show is how you are on Twitter. You share your opinion, and you're not afraid to share your opinion. But people turn to you because they like that. I don't mean this to be like a Alex love fest, but I think that's, you know, that's the key. It's like you have your strategy,
well,
and it's important.
And I guess my thing is that I want people to follow because they like who I am. You know, and if they and there's plenty of people who don't because they've left. They quit it. They quittered.
So, Tim,
so they, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I wanted to throw it to Tim and Lon and ask them as well. Rules of the road when it comes to, you know, different social networks, so that you don't. Here's a question to kind of start this off with. Like, if somebody. And this, I think, is useful for brands. I think it's useful, you know, for individuals that are brands. But if you get mentioned, not an actual at reply, but if you get mentioned in something that's positive, should a brand or a person, you know, weigh in? If somebody is saying, you know, Tim Street is awesome, he's the best web host ever, but they don't at you, is that appropriate for you to say thanks? Or, you know, do you kind of sit back and just see what comes of it? And similarly, what would you tell, you know, brands or small businesses to do?
Well, I look at social media as a cocktail party, and the rules of cocktail party apply. You know, you have to listen first before you jump into the conversation. You can't just walk up to a group of people at a cocktail party and start handing out your business card. You need to listen to what the conversation is, add something important that advances the conversation as opposed to drawing attention to yourself and talking about you. And all those things that run through your head at a cocktail party, they really apply on Twitter. And there's a few other things too, where you know, at a cocktail party, if somebody said something nice about you and you were standing there, you would say thanks. You know, thanks for that. I really appreciate that. Would you walk over to another circle and go, "Hey, Daisy over here said I'm a really good blogger," you know? And so those same rules apply. This is social. The other thing is, and I'm pretty hard and fast about this, although there are definitely some jokesters out there that do it just because they know it's one of my rules, so I still follow them anyway, but I have a 2-coffee rule. If you tell me on Twitter that you're going to get coffee 2 times, I unfollow you.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That is, you know, you've got to have the rules that work for you. All right, so Lon. Let's move aside from the personal a little bit, you know, for folks who have web shows, folks who have, you know, the brands that listen to our show. I think there are some out there. But you know, just aside from the individual, what about this whole issue of social stalking? And, you know, if you follow somebody on Twitter, should you also be following them on Foursquare? Should you also have a Facebook relationship? Like, at what point do you draw the line? I mean, I know, you know, just briefly sort of in my life, like, I tend to, you know, I have a very wide Facebook network, which is why I don't, you know, share pictures of my children or things like that. I just, you know, because it's like the professional Daisy. That's the whole point. It's fun, but, you know, but professional. But I'm very cautious. Like, I don't friend up like my editor or my agent or anything, because I feel like those are kind of very separate, and nor have they reached out to me. I feel like those are very separate business relationships where, like, I don't want to be tempted to engage in social stalking with, you know, with certain relationships. So I just wonder, when it comes to, you know, to brands and to small businesses, how should they find that line between, like, you know, when to follow, when to friend, when to weigh in, when not to?
Yeah, I think on the small business end, at least as Facebook goes, it's a little bit easier with the Facebook page thing, that you can have this interaction and actually solicit the follower versus following somebody hoping that they're going to follow you back. And Twitter, I found the following in Twitter to be a more casual enterprise, in the sense that for our West Hartford site, I frequently go out and search for West Hartford topics and follow people that talk about West Hartford. I had one person write back, "Why are you following me?" But that was it. One out of a few several hundred that we're following now of local people that tend to actually generate some good ideas for us just through the Twitter search and now following them directly. So, it's almost like we're developing a set of etiquette for what's appropriate and what isn't. I've always found the Facebook friend request to be a much more intimate relationship than it would be, I would see, on a Twitter following, mainly because Facebook kind of began as that walled garden, that private network of friends that you're asking to become a part of, whereas Twitter has always focused itself on a very, very public interaction. One thing I've done on Twitter, getting back a little bit on the personal side, but I think important to talk about too, is I actually segmented my Twitter feed out between new media and technology topics, which is my Lon Seidman account, and I actually set up a separate one to talk about things that are happening within Connecticut, because as my, I'm not a Twitter rock star like you two are, or you three are, but my Twitter following since I've come on the show has increased significantly, and many of the people following me on that account are interested in the things that we talk about here and not so much interested in the school board budget next week. So I've really actually created a separate account to talk about Connecticut local topics that have interest to me personally or local political things that I might find interesting. And I think that's something to think about on the Twitter side. And Facebook, I have the same friend curation where I have a limited profile account where I only give people I don't really know just a top level of what I'm posting, no pictures or anything like that.
Right, and I think the bottom line is it's good to have your own kind of rules of the road instead of standards for social media. So many other social media topics that we could touch on this week, but we're going to segue to another topic because social media is fascinating. I mean, it is an area that continues to kind of fascinate me day in and day out on a lot of these questions. I think a lot of our listeners are thinking about. So obviously we'll keep touching on it. I'm not sure if we talked about this on last week's episode because I wasn't here. But a big deal between Netflix and Epix, and Epix is kind of this newer premium network, like a competitor to HBO. It's owned by MGM, Lionsgate, and Paramount, and has done a lot of really interesting new media deals. Epix has really tried to be a network that lives on all platforms. It has carriage deals with a number of cable operators and satellite providers, but also is really pursuing the whole online and broadband strategy at the same time. And having some good success with that. HBO, of course, is sort of the stalwart in this business. And HBO's co-president, Eric Kessler, said to Bloomberg Businessweek that there is value in exclusivity and consumers are, quote, willing to pay a premium for high-quality exclusive content. And basically what he was talking about was, holding back internet rights to titles from Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, and Universal Pictures, and focusing on promoting its own streaming service. Alex, what do you think about HBO's online broadband strategy? Should it be doing a bigger deal with Netflix? Is HBO and other other premium providers, are they in a safer bubble, sort of like how sports networks are, because it's something you often want to watch live? Not that you want to watch HBO live, but where it's sort of in its own bubble, where it's maybe a little bit more immune to sort of new media shifts? Or do you think HBO should be doing wider distribution deals with online services?
I think that I can see why they're trying to maintain control of it. I mean, the issue that HBO has is they've got a pretty sweet deal at the moment with the way that they're getting, I don't know what it is, $8 or $10 or $12, per sub. So when you subscribe to Comcast or whatever, it's something like $8 or $10 or $12 is going to HBO, of your subscription, and that is paying. I believe it's that number that's an accurate number, and. But it's something like that. And so their job is to make sure that they continue to provide that value, and they're getting these checks from all these subscribers. It's a pretty good situation, and I don't think they want to have people be like, well, I can just get it online. And I think that the issue that they have for Netflix is, are they going to get enough money back to replace the possible loss of what they're going to, you know, what's going to happen otherwise. People not subscribing for, they'll just go for the basic cable instead of the one with HBO, and then HBO loses money. And so the question is that's what they're trying to figure out. The problem that I think that we have is that if they don't figure this out, if everyone doesn't figure this out pretty soon, and something like ITV comes out, they won't have any choice. You know, I mean, at some point in time, you know that it's people can play around in this while it's still a market. And I don't know if it'll be Apple. I don't know if it'll be the ITV. But Apple has proven that they're able to take things that are everyone else is trying to figure out, like smartphones or like MP3 players or like netbooks slash you know, touchable screens. They can take that and turn it into a juggernaut. You know, and so you know, I think that as a consumer, I would prefer everything to be in one place. And I think that something like an ITV could provide HBO everything, which is that they can get to the screen, but they can still get both advertising and possibly subscription services, because they could just be an application that sits on top of this ITV or iPad or iPhone platform. So that's my...
And Tim, what company is potentially more powerful? I mean, in this story, Reed Hastings, the Netflix CEO, you know, talks about how his spokesperson, who's quoted as saying, "We would love to do a deal as well with HBO, compete with us or collaborate with us, but we would much rather work with them." Are those fighting words? Is that a suggestion that, you know, Netflix is really aiming to get what it wants?
Well, I can see eventually HBO caving. I mean, Stars is available on Netflix, or at least their movie selection. And I think it boils down to what the licensing deals are for HBO. But, you know, when did HBO go from cable to DirecTV, from cable to Dish? This is just another distribution arm. And once they see the money there and they don't see it as a competitor and they see it as a additional revenue stream, they're going to jump. I really think it'll happen, but people are guarded about Netflix the same way that they are with Apple, and it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, people are always worried, but, you know, you look at the DVD business, you don't just buy your DVDs at Target, they're also for sale at Walmart, and, you know, it for some reason, because it's digital media, people have trouble with that mental hurdle.
Lon, do you agree? Is this all in due time, that eventually these are the sort of things that will get sorted out, and we will see content everywhere? This is sort of just the necessary jostlings at this point in time.
I think so. The market will bear this out as things go. And I kind of got a chuckle because I checked out the HBO Go service, and I used to be an HBO subscriber, and it says, "Oh, you can get access to this wonderful system if you subscribe to the dying, you know, subscription model that we currently offer."
And it promotes it that way too, right? A dying subscription model.
Yeah, I mean, it's I just laughed. I was like, you know what? I'd pay $10 a month to get it, you know, because I have a Mac Mini hooked up to my TV. I'd pay for that, you know, but can't do it. So, you know, I'll just keep giving money to Netflix and be happy. But I think the market will bear this out, and over time we'll see this HBO everywhere we want it to be, or they'll go out of business.
And I just keep getting my HBO shows on DVD from Netflix, since I don't have cable service, as you guys know. I mean, we just watched I don't even know anymore when they actually run on air. We just watched the first season of Hung on DVD, entertaining show. That's, you know,
it's a really good show, by the way. It's really funny.
It's a good show. I really like it. And just Jane Addams, who is, you know, she's, for those of you who don't watch it, she's a pimp. Oh, God, I just think she is hilarious. You know, I mean, just her character development, you know, with Tanya is, you know, it's obviously, you know, it's an HBO show. It's about sex. So for anyone who's concerned about content, probably not for you. But if you're comfortable with various types of content, there's some really, really, I mean, I think the character development is really well done on that show. But yeah, I don't even know anymore when it actually airs. I mean, I'm aware of when True Blood airs, because you can't miss that. Such a big show, and, you know, just become a part of pop culture now. I've actually stopped watching it. Got a little bit too bloody, frankly. A couple other interesting things. Speaking of subscriptions, there are rumors that you know, Hulu might be seen as ready to go public. I don't know. Is that going to happen? Demand Media is, you know, one of the big internet companies that's ready for an IPO. There have been some reports in the New York Times that it's possible that Hulu could go public and potentially at more than $2 billion. Alex, do you see this happening?
I think it could. My question is I don't who's Hulu? No, sorry.
I
felt like they went off with a bang, and now I don't find myself watching them very much. Is anyone else watching them here?
Well,
my wife does, but I don't do it much. Yeah.
And why is that, Lon?
Well, you know what? Part of it's the summer, so yeah. I just don't watch a lot of TV to begin with. I was watching a little bit on there during the fall television season on stuff that my DVR blew up on, but the commercials are kind of annoying. Hate to say it, but that's I would almost pay for the shows that I want to watch commercial free and just go without. And I think also just the hurdles you have to go through to get Hulu content on a television is a bit aggravating also, to the point where I think for some folks pirating might be easier than watching Hulu on their own TV.
Tim, what about you? Are you still? I mean, it's definitely a slow time, and I watch 30 Rock and Glee and The Office, all of that on Hulu. But of course, none of that's going on during the summer. But yeah, there have been folks are saying that Hulu's been talking to investment banks, could potentially pursue an IPO this fall. I mean, do you feel how Alex feels that Hulu is kind of petering off?
Well, I just got a Hulu Plus invite, so
I did too.
I spent my $10 and I got it for my iPad, and I expensed it because I'm in the
because you're an executive now.
I am in the mobile video space, so anything that has video on it that's an app or could have video on it that's an app, I'm interested in that from a business standpoint. I like it. I think it's a pretty elegant app. I do go to Netflix first when I'm looking for something. I don't know what to say. The Hulu app looks really cool, but for some reason it's not top of mind.
And that's interesting, isn't it, that now Netflix has become that way? And I guess it doesn't. I mean, it sort of makes sense if you think about it. Netflix obviously as a company had a much broader reach than Hulu, having started as a quote legacy business, bricks and mortar kind of. But yeah, I'm hearing that from more and more folks, and I'm also hearing it from more regular folks, from people who aren't in the media business, that that they're kind of taken with the Netflix streaming service in a way where you don't hear. I mean, there are obviously plenty of people who are aware of Hulu, but I think there's a much greater awareness outside of our media bubble with the Netflix streaming service. Alex, what do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. Also, is that now there's I was looking for a new, bigger, better TV or something. And
isn't that an eternal pursuit for you? That's a constant, right?
It is. I decided that 46 inches is not big enough. So I was looking at these 55 inch options, and a lot of them are coming with a lot of internet capability built in, where with Wi-Fi or whatever you want to have, you can have Netflix built into the TV. And to me, I was like, whoa, now that really works for me. Like not having, because right now there is a little bit of a hassle to exposing, having to use the little remote. And by the way, for those of you who are making these remotes, Bluetooth is a really great thing, and IR, infrared remotes are kind of last century. That's all I got to say. So the issue is that I think that there's something. The interesting thing about it is I think that that's one of the kind of thing that's having Netflix explode. The fact that there's so much available, and as it becomes more available, and I also think that this is a good reason why we may see a lot of the media companies give Apple a run now. They've tried, I think in many ways, they've tried to keep Apple back. They've seen what happens with Apple when you let them have all the music. But they're at risk. There is no real competitor. I don't think there's any real competitor to Netflix at the moment. The only company, in my opinion, that can compete with Netflix is Apple. And I think that it is a pattern for the media industry to want to have at least two people fighting over their attentions, and not get into this thing where one company has all the control over their distribution pipe. And while they're constantly experimenting with their own stuff, I think that they're starting to realize that Netflix is starting to get possibly an insurmountable lead, and I think that might lead to something like ITV coming up, so where they can make sure that it stays an open market.
We've got one final story that we're going to touch on before we wrap today. Starcom, media agency, and Berman Braun, digital content developer, Hollywood-based producers, struck a multi-million dollar deal, a lot of money. It's a four-year deal, could be worth about $100 million, according to reports. I'm quoting from a Media Post story written by Wayne Friedman. So basically, under this deal, Starcom clients will kind of have a first look at new advertising opportunities for digital content that Berman and Braun might be producing. Starcom's clients in branded entertainment include Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, and Walmart's obviously no small shakes when it comes to marketers. Berman Braun is founded by Gail Berman. She's the ex-head of entertainment at Fox Network, and Lloyd Braun, who was an ABC programming executive. Tim, we've got a Hollywood pedigree here, but I don't know that these folks have had a tremendous amount of success yet on the web. Nevertheless, perhaps with the, it's not just going to be web video, but digital content. What do you think about this type of deal? We haven't seen one like this in a while, but it's interesting to see that it's with a big media agency company.
You know, this kind of dream that the kind of deal that people dream of, you know, and it's like, wow. I hope they don't screw it up, because it would be great if more of these types of deals happen. I mean, these are obviously people that understand the business of advertising. I mean, for years, you know, they courted advertisers to get that money to sponsor their shows. So they understand how this works. They understand the business of advertising and of creating content for advertisers to advertise on. So, I'm interested to see where this goes. I'm also interested to see if, you know, if anybody else is going to get a deal like this. I would be placing my money on Barry Diller's guys, Ben
Alectus,
Silverman.
Alectus
and Jordan Hoffner from YouTube. I would, you know, if you put their names on this deal, it would totally make sense, and we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. But because it's the old school guys that are kind of here that aren't really considered the digital crowd, it's kind of like you're scratching your head a little bit. But these are smart people, so I think it'll work out.
Lon, does this signal anything about even more money coming into the pipeline for digital production? I mean, i.e., is there any chance that there'll be that trickle-down effect? Not necessarily with this $100 million per se,
right.
But just, you know, that'll bring more money into it.
Yeah, I'll take 0.5% of that. I'm happy to do that. I don't need much. We're all about lean and mean. We can do a lot with a little bit, and that's what we're really taking pride in right now. But yeah, I think any money coming into the sector is a good thing. And I think it, you know, anything that we can do to get people to really look at this as serious content, which we all know it is good for all of us. And another thing that has also been percolating out there as well is that we've all known that addressing the niche audience is really critical. And there's a lot of great shows that have gone off the air recently that had a niche audience, myself included. Some of them just, you know, maybe a little bit too geeky or wacky for most of the general TV audience, that, you know, have found some decent revenue opportunities and DVD releases and that kind of thing. So this is another area where, this could be where everything goes. We'll see more content, smart things that are maybe smaller in production size, smaller in budget, but, you know, laser beamed out to a very specific group of people, and I'd be interested to see how this develops.
Alex, your thoughts?
Oh, I think I'm excited to see, you know, that money coming into the market.
It's good for the market. Yeah.
I think it keeps on underlying that this is a valid market. I mean, I have a lot of stuff that, you know, we're developing, both in nonfiction as well as narrative, you know, shorts and so on and so forth for the web. We're kind of waiting, you know, hoping to, you know, getting our capacity ready to go for it, as well as, you know, waiting for that market to really mature. And every time you see something like this, you just see that it's maturing quickly.
Let's hope that a rising tide lifts all ships with a deal like this. So kudos to Berman Braun and Starcom. We hope you do great things with it. Looks like we're near the end of the show. I just want to remind our listeners, hey, feel free to become our friend on the TWIM Facebook page, and we probably won't even, you know, do creepy things like post your location. we're good like that. We're thoughtful. Alex, where can people find you online?
They can find me on Twitter, all one word, Alex Lindsay. And also, you can go up to pixelgore.com or see the shows like this one at pixelgore.tv.
And you can follow him on Twitter or you can quit him on Twitter. Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com, where I blog about web and mobile video, and at mdialogue.com. Daisy, I'm really curious if you can talk at all about your book tour or not. I know we didn't get to it, and I was like, oh, I wanted to hear about it.
Sure, yeah. I'll talk briefly about it, and then we'll finish wrapping. But yeah, my book doesn't come out for 2 more months. It releases on November 2nd. It's The Mockingbird. It's being published by Little Brown. But I went on what's called a pre-pub tour, and it's not actually pre-publicity, pre-publication. But basically, I went to 3 different markets. I went to Seattle, Boston, and Chicago last week with my publicist from Little Brown, which was just kind of amazing and really cool, because, you know, I've always been on the other side. I've always been the person as a reporter, you know, calling publicists, and oh my gosh, now I actually have one, which is still kind of mystifying and really a total dream come true. So we traveled to these different places, and we had 4 events. 3 of the events were dinners with industry people. You know, we met with booksellers and librarians in different markets, you know, folks who are, you know, heading up independent bookstores, as well as Barnes & Noble and Borders. And then, you know, librarians who are obviously setting a lot of agendas in terms of recommending books to teens. And just, you know, had dinner with them, got to know them, got to talk about my book, just kind of talk about the business in general, and just really a chance to, you know, obviously Little Brown is trying to present me as, you know, this new author that obviously they believe in. And then the best part was when I was in Chicago, I got to do an event at Anderson's Bookshop, which is really popular and influential independent bookstore in the Chicago area. It's in Naperville. And Becky Anderson, who runs that, has a great network of local teens. And she brought about 30 of them to this event at her warehouse, and they'd all read a galley of my book. So I got to have, it was my first event with real teenagers, with my core audience. Although, of course, the book is appealing to anyone 14 and up. I have to give that disclaimer. So adults will love it too. But it was great. It was really, really wonderful. And just so, I'd say it was really encouraging and inspiring to be in front of the teens, especially because, as I said, that's the core audience that I'm writing for. And, you know, just it was wonderful for me to just kind of see who they are and who they want to be and what they're aspiring to do and kind of their passions. And a lot of what my novel is about, it's, you know, deals with justice and standing up and speaking up and, you know, and things like that. And it was just wonderful. The idealist to me just loved seeing, you know, these 15 and 16 year olds who are already sort of figuring out, you know, that they are idealistic and passionate. And, you know, and Alex, I'm sure you encounter this a lot, you know, in your travels on the road and interacting with a lot of different people, but it's really wonderful to see this younger generation just kind of be excited about things like social change and, you know, standing up when they see bad things happening around them. And obviously bad things continue to happen to everybody, you know, in teenage circles. You know, you hear about, you know, bullying and hate speech and things like that. And sadly, that is a part of our society, but it is also amazing to really see young people who do stand up for themselves and their friends and for others. So
I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg of what these social networks are capable of.
Yeah.
We have no idea what's going to happen when this is a fully operational battle station. The ability to you know, the you know, I when we think about the tech, you know, the tech folks and the kids that used to get picked on when we were in high school and everything else, you know, sometimes I just think, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The thing is these guys are going to be able to, they're going to be able to defend themselves. They're going to be able to do things. When people are empowered with these things, it becomes very hard to control them, you know, and which is a concern. You know, a lot of governments would like to. But I think that, but in many social areas and everything else, I mean, we're really just seeing little inklings of something that's going to be such a big factor as we go into the next 10 or 20 years.
And, you know, I'm a big believer in speaking up and empowerment, and that's definitely some of the things that my novel touches on. It's great to be able to talk about it and, you know, and tie it back into technology, which is what we do on this on the show. But thank you for asking, Tim. That was very, very sweet of you and thoughtful of you to ask. Lon, where can people find you?
They can find me on the amazing social network Twitter at LONSEIDMAN, and you can check us out at localonlinenews.tv to see the latest local news in Connecticut, if that's your thing.
And a big shout out to Jason Perrier, who without him we really could not do this show anymore, as well as Suzanne Llewellyn, who is our producer. Jason is also on the production side and does a wonderful job along with Suzanne coming up with many of the stories that we touch on every week. He's on Twitter at Jason Perrier, P-E-R-R-I-E-R, is how his last name is spelled. So thank you, Jason, for all that you do. You definitely make my life easier, and I know you make Alex's life easier, too. So if you're looking for me, you can find me at DaisyWhitney.com and Daisy Whitney on Twitter. And this mess you've been listening to was recorded on Tuesday, August 24th, 2010. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.